Thelema, Coast to Coast, show number 7, July 19th, 2005. That will should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow. Once more, today's show is full of information, so my part is going to be short. First, we have an interview with Keith418 about the Thelema community and the tendency for people to want validation but not do the work. After Keith418, we have a 47-minute interview with the OTO Internet Secretary, Craig Berry. We will end the podcast with music from the band Nuit. I know in the last podcast I said I would be answering listener emails in this one, but I do want to keep the program length reasonable, so I promise I'll be answering a large number of emails in the next podcast. If you have questions, please send them to podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com, and I will get to as many as possible in the next podcast. One question I did want to answer is, what is the purpose of this podcast? The long version of this answer could take up a considerable amount of time, so I'll give a short version. Basically, I want the podcast to foster dialogue in the Thelemic community, document and expand people's awareness of what's going on in the Thelemic community today, and lastly, to start looking critically at the Thelemic community in general, and all Thelemic organizations in particular, to start raising our standards as a community. To do this, I interview well-known and less-known personalities, talk about events and organizations, as well as point out some useful reference material. This is also listeners of the podcast can become better informed about what is going on around them in their community, state, country, and the world. With the advent of the internet and mass communication, the world is much smaller. The result is that what we all do greatly affects the community, large and small. It is my hope that some of the material on this podcast can contribute to the dialogue in the community and also spotlight some of the things that are working and some of the things that can be improved. I hope this answers the question adequately. As I said, I could elaborate more, but for now, this will have to work. One other note. I've been having some issues with the jerry-rigged setup I have to record phone interviews. The result is that they have varying degrees of background noise and some volume issues, especially when I am speaking. I am actively trying to find a better solution to record the interviews without the added cost of a dedicated phone line. Please be patient as I work on these issues. Thank you. With that said, let's get right into the interview with Keith418.
Hello, Keith, you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to this podcast. In the last podcast, we were talking about people in the Thelemic community actually not producing things. And kind of following that line of thought, we have people not producing material, yet they're looking for validation and credit. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think one of the things we have to look at in the community is this like kind of constant problem that a variety of expectations and sort of presuppositions set up. And people don't come to the OTO or to the larger Thelema community looking to be instructed and taught and taken from a place where they don't really know too much and don't really have a serious set of skills in the occult to a place where they are masters or are adepts or are people that have a serious skill set and a serious kind of credibility from their work. So instead of looking, it's like instead of going to school to be taught, you go to school to be validated for what a great person you already are. And that doesn't make any sense. I mean, that's sort of the self-esteem movement in contemporary education bleeding over into the occult community. It's very dangerous. Because, you know, people come to me and they're like, give me validation and respect because I'm this amazing person, not what do I need to do to get validation and respect, or what do I need to do to get to the point where I want to be at? They already think they're there, and they think the goal of the community is just to recognize them and their greatness. And that doesn't, you know, make too much sense to me. I think that's really destructive, because if you're not coming to the community to learn and to, you know, participate and to realize that you have to, you know, meet certain expectations, meet certain standards, and do some work in order to get that validation, then, you know, what's the real point? Are we here just to validate you for being you? This is like the Rosie Grier free to be you and me kind of secular humanist egalitarianism that coming home to roost. You know, I'm not here just to give you credit for being you. You know, there may be liberal elementary school teachers around who can do that. That's not what I'm really about. I'm about recognizing people who do serious work, produce serious, you know, important things, and have something to contribute that's meaningful. And you only get that chance to produce things that are meaningful when you struggle and work to overcome and work to develop. You don't get that just by, you know, plopping yourself down in the middle of existence and say, hey, I'm me, I'm wonderful, you know, accept me as I am, give me unconditional validation and support. That's just, you know, I'm not going to get roped into that. I don't know if you've seen that, but I've seen quite a bit of it.
Now, when you say you, do you mean you personally as Keith418, or you're saying, like, the person talking to the Thelemic community, and the Thelemic community should be going back to that person and say, what validation for what, that you're not doing any work?
I think both. I mean, I personally am not going to give a lot of respect or validation to people who don't produce anything that's interesting. And we talked about this the last time, too. I mean, what's interesting doesn't have to be, you know, a new chapter to the Book of the Law, or even an occult text, period. It could be any number of things. But it has to be something. The great work is work. You know, this is what a friend of mine was pointing out. It's not just like lounging around being yourself and getting credit and hosannas for that. I mean, I think a lot of times the Thelemic community becomes this place where failures and basically dysfunctional people gather together to either support each other's, you know, delusions of grandeur, or at best not question them. And I think that's kind of, you know, sense of brotherhood among failures is really, really destructive and dysfunctional. I want no part of that. I mean, I'm looking for peer relationships with people who've done a lot of work, who take this stuff really seriously, and can participate, you know, in a meaningful way. But this whole idea of you should just get credit for being you, that's very dangerous. That's very, that's really bad, because, you know, you can be a complete idiot, you can be lazy, you can do absolutely nothing, and then waltz in and expect, oh, make me a ninth degree, you know, and recognize me as an adept just because I'm myself. And, you know, I think as a whole, the community is caught between realizing that that's not really what we want and buying into this egalitarian morality, which feels that we have to give everybody credit for being themselves no matter what they do.
I'd like you to expand more on the kind of things that work that people could do, in your opinion, that isn't necessarily writing books or writing essays or writing or producing artwork.
You know, it depends. It's like what their, you know, function is in life. I mean, I have one occult teacher who's, you know, and I've written about this, who is very vicious about demanding that people tell him very simply what they're here for. You know, in the universe, like, you have arrived in three-dimensional, four-dimensional reality, whatever. What are you here for? Who are you? What do you do? And I'll admit that, you know, when I was asked that question, it produced something of a crisis in for me. You know, I was unhappy to hear that on a certain level. I didn't like being put on the spot that way. And it made me very uncomfortable. And ultimately, having to answer my teacher, you know, with a response, was one of the most healthy and important, you know, steps I think I've ever taken. But, you know, it definitely was not easy for me, and it did produce a crisis. And I think that's really what people have to confront. What are they here for? What are you here for? When, you know, what are you here to do? What are you really about? And then do that. And the people that can answer that question and can confront that usually are producing things that are, you know, valuable and important for us. And it doesn't matter what it is, but it's they have to know that.
What is the role of the OTO initiations in the community?
Well, I mean, I think that's a very lengthy sort of question. I mean, I think for the OTO, the initiations are tremendously important, and I think that they're, you know, immensely valuable.
But I mean in this recognition and,
well,
you know, doing the work.
I mean, you know, the OTO has to sort of understand what it wants. The leaders have to know where they want to move the organization and what it's going to take to get there. And the initiation rituals, as well as the Gnostic Mass and, you know, everything else about the organization, from the newsletter to the buildings to everything else, should all be part of moving it in that direction. And, you know, there's a very famous line which I quote a lot, which says, you know, I wish I knew who said this because it's a terrific line, but it's ambition that fails to reckon with sacrifice results in neurosis. And the OTO leaders sometimes make very ambitious comments about what they want, but I don't see them reckoning with the sacrifice that it's going to take to get those things. So consequently, the organization is dysfunctional and neurotic. You know, I don't think that's really debatable. So you can ask people, well, what is it that you want, and are you reckoning with the sacrifice that it's going to take to get that? And if you think that you can have what you want without any sacrifice, I think you're living in, you know, Robert Anton Wilson frou-frou land. You know, I don't think that that's a reasonable or in any way correct assumption. I think we have to look at, you know, opportunity costs, the idea that if we want one thing, it means we can't have the other things. If we work on one thing, it means we can't work on something else. All of these things are very unhappy-making for a lot of people who associate maximum freedom with maximum choices and realize that as soon as they commit to any one particular goal or any one particular path, that they necessarily give up a whole bunch of different options. But in the end, the only people who ever advance and make progress are people who pick certain options and stick to them, and the people who try to keep all their options open forever wind up with nothing.
Right.
So, you know, to me, to answer your question directly, the initiation should move everybody in the group, you know, together towards the goals the leaders are pushing for the organization. It's, you know, from a direction that's coming from the sovereign sanctuary of the Gnosis. And that's a big thing. You know, that's a very large thing. But the idea that the rituals just sort of exist in a vacuum of any sort of larger organization, and that, you know, you can just come in, get the ritual, and then leave again, go out into the ozone, you know, I think is mistaken.
Well, I hate to cut you off here, but the interview after this one is lengthy, and so we're going to have to stop at this point, but we'll continue in the next podcast.
Okay.
So thank you very much,
no
and
problem.
I'll talk to you later.
Thanks for having me.
Over the last 5 to 6 podcasts, a number of interviews have been critical of the OTO leadership and the Thelemic community in general. This might give the impression that I or this podcast are down on the OTO. I assure you this is far from the truth. I wholeheartedly support the organization and its legitimacy while, at times, am critical of the particular policies or leadership decisions. To that end of fostering all sides of dialogue, I invited the OTO Internet Secretary, Craig Berry, to be on the podcast and talk about his experiences in the OTO. Craig Berry has been in the OTO for almost 2 decades and has had a unique opportunity to watch it grow. Along with being the Internet Secretary, he also wears the hat of an SGIG, EGC Bishop, and a member of many U.S. Grand Lodge committees, some of which are discussed in the interview. I think Craig gives an interesting perspective about the OTO in the interview, and I hope the listeners find it very informative.
We have on the phone with us Craig Berry, the Internet Secretary for the OTO. Are you there, Craig?
I am indeed.
Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you.
Let's start off by going into your past history, and can you talk to us about how you got started with the OTO, when you got started, and what the environment was like?
Sure thing. I actually joined the OTO at the long-defunct Azoth Oasis in Los Angeles in 1987, which was, I always think of myself as being sort of a member of the intermediate generation of OTO, because it was just after Hymenaeus Alpha died and after Hymenaeus Beta had become the outer head of the order, but of course long before the creation of U.S. Grand Lodge. So if you were to sort of divide the modern era of OTO into three epochs, I was very much in at the beginning of the middle one. And, of course, the people who were around during Hymenaeus Alpha's reign looked down on us as the newbies. But it was an interesting time to join the order. The structure of things was very, very different. Obviously, there was no U.S. Grand Lodge. Everything was run directly by the international government. The structure of local bodies at the time was quite different and a bit more independent than the current model. And there was the concept of satellite bodies. Azoth was actually a satellite body, as it was known at the time, of Baphomet Lodge in Los Angeles. So that was my sort of primary affiliation at the time that I joined up.
When you joined and took Minerval, how large was the Oasis?
Well, the Oasis as such was really just a location for events within Baphomet Lodge. It didn't really have an independent identifiable membership. At the time, satellite bodies were handed out relatively freely and were basically event venues for whatever the principal body was. So really, you'd have to talk about what Baphomet Lodge was. And I'd say the membership at Baphomet, the active membership when I joined up, was in the neighborhood of 15 to 20 people, and then, of course, the usual sort of haze of peripheral people who came and went.
After Baphomet Lodge, did you continue with that body or go into other bodies? Or how did your initiatory progress continue?
I took all of my Man of Earth degrees at Baphomet Lodge or its satellite bodies. Baphomet Lodge actually became the master of Baphomet Lodge in 1992 and was master through when the lodge was closed in 95. There was a whole local political brouhaha that ended up that being the best solution. And it's actually worked out extremely well. We have some very healthy local bodies in Los Angeles now. So in retrospect, I think a whole series of the right decisions were made there. But then following that, of course, it was lover's triad degrees that were, you know, given in other venues.
So how have you seen the OTO changing, I guess, from when you took initiation in that middle period and advanced through the degrees and then going into the latter period, which I guess would be around the creation of U.S. Grand Lodge?
Yeah, I would definitely see that the creation of U.S. Grand Lodge as being sort of a convenient historical marker. I mean, obviously, it's taken time for the resulting changes to filter out, and progress has been different in different areas. But, you know, it's always convenient to be able to draw thick lines on the chart, and that definitely makes a good one. And as for how things have changed with respect to initiation specifically, was that your question?
Well, that would be a good place to start.
Okay. Well, obviously, this is going to be a different answer in different parts of the country. Different people had different approaches, and the variability was much wider back then between both standards of practice, you know, in terms of, you know, the degree of simple technical prowess and ability and resources brought to bear on the problem, and also what was considered to be, you know, the proper way to perform these various rituals. A lot of the standardization that we've seen since then hadn't happened. It happens that since I was part of Southern California OTO, and Southern California OTO has obviously given us our current king and a good chunk of U.S. Grand Lodge, that probably of all the people in the world, I'm the one who will have seen the least change over the years, because a lot of the ideas that came out of the Southern California OTO in the late 80s ended up being the nucleus of ideas from which U.S. Grand Lodge was formed, and which in turn have been reflected outward as you know, national policies. That being said, probably the primary difference that I would see in the initiations over the years has been an ever-increasing standard of performance, both on the magical plane, you know, people truly living and learning and doing the parts on every plane, you know, putting their full selves into it in a way that maybe wasn't always the case before. And also on the physical level, just better facilities, better equipment, you know, just a general rising standard on every possible level. You know, with some glitches and blips along the way, but that's definitely been the overall trend.
Do you think that trend would also extend to kind of the environment and the just the overall functionality of the bodies, the maturing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's been just a night and day difference. And obviously it hasn't been a uniform ramp of progress. There have been plenty of wrong turns and nasty situations along the way. But both from within and from without, there has been a marked increase in the maturity of the local bodies. You know, when I say from within, people, the people who have, you know, come to power over the local bodies, local body masters and officers and senior members, are simply insisting on, you know, a more rigorous approach to every aspect of running the body. Probably the one that's easiest to measure is financial, because, you know, that's amenable to actual examination of balance sheets and reports and so forth. But it reflects into the less tangible things as well, including, for example, the standards of performance that I was talking about previously. And a lot of that, the bulk of that, I believe, has been driven from within the local bodies that have achieved that progress, which is, I think, a really important point, because the local bodies of the order are the point of the order. That's where all of the important mission of the OTO is performed or not performed. Anything outside of the local bodies is a support structure to make the local bodies more effective at the job they do. The point of the order is the local body. It's not Grand Lodge. It's not IHQ. And so anything, any effective change that's going to happen, any progress that's made is going to happen on the ground at the local bodies. And there, you know, there's a lot that Grand Lodge and IHQ can do to facilitate that and to direct that and to remove obstacles from that path. But in the, at the end of the day, what happens, happens at the oases, at the camps, at the lodges.
The Electoral College has, for a number of years now, been collecting annual reports about the functionality and the events and things that the actual local bodies are doing.
Right.
Do you see any trends within that data? I don't know if you've have seen that kind of data, but does that also seem to show a level of maturing within the local bodies and the functionality?
Absolutely it does. And part of that is just the effect of knowing that someone is paying attention. You know, it's the famous work study that was done during World War II where they were trying to determine optimum lighting levels in a factory. So they took two groups of workers and put one of them in dim lights and one in bright lights, and they both got more effective because they knew they were being watched. That's a very real effect, that when you know that your charter depends on the Electoral College approving of the work you're doing, and you know that they're collecting and analyzing data, it's in your best interest to make that data look good, and that's just simple human psychology. So yeah, I'm sure that the causality on this runs both directions. That being said, if you look at what's coming in the annual reports, you're seeing a lot of very rigorous, structured activity in the local bodies. And as I mentioned before, the easiest place to see that is simply in the fact that from on the Oasis and Lodge levels, we're demanding quarterly financial reports. Which has actually been part of the bylaws since time immemorial, but for the last several years they've actually been expected and examined, you know, filed with the treasurer, you know, lightly audited to make sure they're consistent and coherent and so forth. And, you know, now it's just a question of you do that or you're not playing the game and your charter is pulled. And holding people to that standard, you know, obviously forces a measure of maturity and coherence and planning just so that you keep sufficiently complete records to support that reporting function. But again, that's what people tend to focus on because it's so measurable. It's, you know, it's right out there. Anyone can look at a financial report and see, you know, in numeric form, which is always, you know, the easiest to do quantitative analysis on. But even beyond that, you're seeing a lot more bodies that are pulling off, you know, seemingly simple but very important things, like just offering an absolutely reliable regular series of classes, offering a regular cycle of the Man of Earth initiations at predictable times of the year. You know, there's no longer the enormous problem there used to be with getting people to do simple reporting on initiation status. You know, everyone seems to have fallen into the groove of expecting that it is the norm to do reporting. It is reasonable that Grand Lodge needs to be informed of various things, and that at the local body level, it's actually helpful to get into that mode. It's one of those things that once you start thinking in that way, the benefits are purely local, but it's a good example of the case where the external influence of Grand Lodge can sort of kickstart people into that mode so that they have a chance to see the benefits of it.
what other benefits do you think the local bodies have from the implementation of a U.S. Grand Lodge and the maturing of U.S. Grand Lodge since its implementation in the mid-90s?
There are a lot of different benefits. I mean, it's interesting because this gets into a really interesting issue, which is, what are the goals of leadership? Why do you need leadership? I mean, the first question you have to ask yourself is, if the local bodies are succeeding independently, what's the value add of Grand Lodge? What can IHQ and Grand Lodge do that the local bodies can't? And really, what it comes down to is that leaders are about setting directions and monitoring the progress toward goals. And even more so, the idea of removing obstacles and dealing with exceptions. A well-functioning local body that has all of its ducks in a row and is, you know, just tooling along without any difficulties will have little need of Grand Lodge support in general. Where the difficulties come in is when there's a problem on the ground. There's an unhappy change of mastership, or someone gets into office who doesn't know what the procedures are, or there's, you know, fundamental conflict between two, you know, warring cliques within the Oasis, or whatever it might be. So one of the primary functions of Grand Lodge is being an external arbiter with hopefully a little bit of experience and wisdom to bring to bear, so that when things do go off the rails, the body isn't left out by itself in the cold trying to solve them. There's someone to turn to, or if things get to this point, someone to step in to help resolve these issues, which in former times, before there was this sort of strong central authority available, typically would just tear the local body apart. I mean, there were, I think at the time I joined, there were upwards of 60 local bodies, as opposed to just over 40 now. And 40 actually is a slight recovery. We were in the high 30s for a while because local bodies were being created with wild abandon and were blowing up just as frequently. So there was a sort of churn of local bodies coming and going. I think the availability of assistance from Grand Lodge, and in the form of not only the guidance and reporting requirements and things that help people get into a stable operating basis, you know, all must be done well in a business way, but also the availability of the tribunal and the Sovereign Grand Inspectors General and mentors from the Electoral College and all these various resources to turn to has really helped stabilize the local bodies. So the first time they hit a problem they can't handle, they don't disappear in a puff of smoke.
I do want to come back to some of this, but
okay.
I also wanted to touch on your particular role within this as a U.S. Grand Lodge officer and the Internet Secretary. Let's talk a little bit about the technology that you work with within the OTO and kind of on a broader spectrum, Thelema. Since you've been in the IT industry for over two decades, how have you seen technology help the growth of Thelema? And in particular, how has it helped the U.S. Grand Lodge or the OTO in general? And then also, what have been the pros of it and also some of the cons?
By all means, and if I miss any of those, do ask me, because it's quite a mouthful. First off, Thelemites in general, I mean, there are certainly exceptions, but in general, we seem to run toward the technophilic side of the spectrum. We are largely early adopters of every new technology that comes along, particularly communication technologies. So from the very first, from the era of bulletin board systems, with dial-up networks calling each other back and forth and spreading these topic conferences, there have always been a disproportionate number of Thelemic magicians making use of these systems to communicate with one another. And I still remember the absolute glee when these things became available and suddenly you could have these deep, wonderful conversations with people you'd never met but who had the same interests that you did. It was incredibly powerful. And that power is still there, absolutely. It's funny, you know, it's one of my daydreams is, you know, reincarnating Aleister Crowley and showing him the U.S. Grand Lodge website and saying every day people are seeing Thelema than thought in your lifetime.
Right.
And just the absolute beauty of that, that with this technology we can reach out. The law is for all. And now anyone, anywhere with a web browser can find us. At the time that I joined the order, it was impossible to find. There was, you know, that one card in the back of the tarot deck that had the address, the old JAF address in New York. And there were a periodical here and there, and local bodies were in the habit of stuffing flyers into books, which happens to be the way that I found the order. A copy of Aha up in San Jose, appropriately enough. But definitely an aha moment. But, you know, it was very difficult to find the order. And even if you found the order as a whole, it was then difficult to find out if there was anyone doing it locally to you. And it was this whole epic struggle to determine that the OTO still existed at all. I mean, I still remember when I started reading about Crowley, I had the firm impression that all of this was ancient history, that it all withered up and blown away long ago. And I still remember my utter delight to find that it was still around. Well, nowadays, anyone with a web browser can discover not only that the OTO is still around, but where their nearest local body is and how to apply and what our philosophies and processes are immediately. And it's funny because there's a romantic part of me that kind of misses the Indiana Jones school of finding the OTO. But on the whole, I think this is much better. Now, the interesting problem, of course, is that we are all political animals, and one of my favorite sayings is that any time three people get within shouting distance of one another, politics spring up. And the net brings groups of three or 300 or 3,000 people within shouting distance of one another continuously, 24 hours a day. So many, many problems that wouldn't have been problems become problems because of the amplifying effect of net communications. And this is really, to me, the greatest downside of the net, is that problems that would have been forgotten or would have been quietly handled locally suddenly become worldwide causes for concern and conflict. And it's, you know, it's hard to argue with visibility and with, full communication, but there are times you really do have to wonder if, you know, every piece of dirty laundry coming out of some, you know, camp on the other side of the nation should necessarily have the attention of all the world's Thelemites or all the world's OTO members. And it's a quandary, and it's one I don't think we're going to be able to resolve anytime soon, because, of course, everyone wants to be in the know. Everyone wants to know what's going on. So that goes back and forth. It's funny, you'll see a lot of people blaming LiveJournal for half the order's modern problems. And I always tell people, it's not LiveJournal. LiveJournal is just the particular manifestation. It's communication. Communication for good and ill is what the issue is here. And if it weren't LiveJournal, it would be something else. This was going on the old Thelema 93 list in 1987. It's never going to go away so long as everyone can talk to one another immediately 24 hours a day. Now, turning back to another part of your question, and a much happier one, how Grand Lodge is making use of net technology. Well, as I'm sure you know, Grand Lodge is not a physical place. It's a concept. It's a group of people holding various offices, but we're spread out over the entire country. So all of our business has to be conducted remotely. And I find it really neat, actually, that U.S. Grand Lodge and the web came into existence in effectively the same year, because the two have definitely had a symbiotic relationship. We do a great deal of our communication by email. We do a great deal of our planning and communication and sharing of documents over the web. We do the Electoral College holds their semi-annual online meetings on an IRC server hosted on the Grand Lodge site. Now, all of these things make possible a distributed government that really wouldn't be practical in the days of phone calls and postal letters. You really couldn't have the level of coordination that we have without having everyone located in the same place and have physical meetings with one another. So in that sense, it's been extraordinarily positive. Now, one of the problems that we have is that we're far too dependent on Yahoo groups, which, you know, are both the blessing and bane of everyone's existence. They offer yes. an absolutely amazing package of services in one neat bundle. With one identity, one login, you have a really excellent mailing list manager and a file sharing system and a poll manager and all these other doohickeys, and whoever owns the group has enormous flexibility in how they control the group and what access they give to whom. And I have been, quite frankly, on a hunt for the last 3 years for a technology that we could host locally to the Grand Lodge site that would be a drop-in replacement for Yahoo Groups, offering that same umbrella security across more or less the same mix of features, and I have come up empty. It's just, with each passing day, I respect the programmers at Yahoo more because they've really got an amazing system there. But I am under orders from our Supreme and Holy King to rectify the situation, so I'm working on it.
The Yahoo Groups, that really was a big boon for the OTO in the past, wasn't it? I mean, that allowed a lot of disparate members within the order at a lot of different levels, whether they're a body master or an assistant body master or in a Rosecroix chapter level or various other levels, to actually start communicating with other body masters or with other members at that same degree level.
Well, exactly. I mean, the body masters list is a beautiful example, although it's misnamed. It's actually body officers, but no one ever seems to get around to changing that. it's a tradition. Look at it that way. Someday scholars will debate on why it's called that. But, yeah, that's a beautiful example of where not only are policies announced there so that everyone can see them immediately, but they're discussed there. If questions come up, usually if one person has a question about something, it means that 30 others do too, but they're too scared or too busy to ask it. So even if one person spots a problem or an inconsistency or doesn't quite understand the applicability or whatever, if they ask it, then everyone benefits from seeing the answer. It's an enormous multiplier that happens.
Also,
that is you know, I think the best of what the net is doing for us.
And going back to the great functionality of the Yahoo Groups, those messages are archived and searchable. So if somebody coming in later
Precisely. Could
search on it and actually pull up that conversation of clarification about any particular policy or something.
Exactly. And of course, it also can be embarrassing when you say something unequivocally and somebody goes to the archive and says, well, last year you said the exact opposite.
Well, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Freedom is a two-edged sword.
Bingo.
There.
Exactly right.
So where do you see the technology other than integrating some kind of Yahoo Group messaging style functionality within the U.S. Grand Lodge website? What other kind of technology prerogatives are you looking at?
Well, there's a lot of different things going on right now. Probably the most interesting one is that I am experimenting with Wiki, which we're using for a couple of purposes already, but I'm hoping to open that up as a workspace for other parts of Grand Lodge and local bodies to use for sort of scribbling plans, notes, ideas, reference materials, whatever, and along, you know, the Flamapedia or Wikipedia model, everyone contributing. Obviously, that couldn't be used for anything that was degree-sensitive or otherwise private, but I think there's a lot of value in having a place where people can just sort of construct little subsites for themselves for organizing local body projects or for Grand Lodge entities communicating with one another or whatever it might be. So that's one thing that I'm working on very actively. We also have a public key server up that's been used just for a few of the Grand Lodge officers so far while I make sure that the key server is itself secure, which is rather ironic. But if that proves out, I'm going to be opening up that for use by the general membership.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. For those who aren't aware, what is a public key server and what does that technology do for the officers?
Basically, public key cryptography is a system of secure communication which solves the age-old problem of how you get the secret to the person you're communicating to in order to communicate with them. It basically allows you to publish a public key, hence the name, which is paired with a private key, which you keep yourself, and anyone who has your public key can write a secure message to you, which only you with your private key can decrypt. So it's beautifully asymmetric. It means the public keys can be just put out in plain view, and as long as you keep your private key safe, everything will be secure. It's one of the greatest breakthroughs in security and ever, quite frankly. It's really quite remarkable. A public key server, then, is simply a place, a trusted place that is a repository of various people's public keys. So if you wanted to send an email to webmaster@oto-usa.org, you could go there, look up what the public key is for that email address, and send me a message securely, which only I would then be able to decrypt. And obviously, in our organization, there's a number of things which we have to be careful with. Beyond, obviously, the degree secrets, we're dealing with a lot of personal information, you know, people's names, addresses, things that some people are very protective of. So we obviously have to take a good deal of care that as we transfer information between officers or store it on servers, that it's in a form such that even if the server were compromised, it wouldn't do anyone any good without knowing the keys involved. So we're making a lot of use of, specifically PGP has become the standard, which stands for Pretty Good Privacy, which is an open source implementation of public key cryptography.
Now, I also note that recently the OTO has formed an IT guild.
That's
and
right.
You're a member of that. Can you talk about the process of the founding of it and what the goals of the IT Guild are within the OTO?
Yeah, by all means. The founding of it was actually kind of an interesting story. I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase, but the Electoral College often says that the criterion for forming a local body is whether it's quacking like a duck. That if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck and waddles like a duck, it's probably a duck. And they apply the same criterion to local bodies. If it's acting like a local body, it probably is one. Well, the guilds are being treated the same way. The way you start a guild is to start acting like a guild. So about a year ago, a group of people with similar ambitions and I started up a Yahoo group called OTO Online Volunteers and began discussing, you know, what we could do as a guild, what the organization might be, and also helping people out with their computer problems, helping out local body webmasters and Grand Lodge officers and so forth to resolve issues that, as they came up that were in the IT field so that we were, you know, doing the thing that this guild would do. And sure enough, last spring, the Areopagus chartered the IT guild, the third guild chartered in by IHQ, and we've set about the process of actually implementing the bylaws, which has taken us longer than I expected because we got kind of a false start over the summer. But in the meantime, we're now admitting our first large group of members. We have a number in the pipeline right now, and we should be up to speed by midsummer. But in the meantime, there's been a lot of discussion about what to do now that we have the IT Guild. You know, which of these ideas that we are tossing around are actually the ones that are most worth pursuing. And one of the ones that's bubbling to the top of that list is providing a service similar to what the mentor program in the Electoral College does, but being specifically tech mentors, basically putting your name into a pool of people who are willing to help out local bodies or Grand Lodge officers or whatever who have some sort of project that they're doing. I mean, the canonical example would be a local body that desperately wants to start or improve their website, but none of their members are web savvy. Somebody from the IT Guild could volunteer their time to go in and help them out with that, and thereby, of course, do the local body a service, but also put a feather in their own cap. If they were a web developer, they could show this off as an example of their work. It gives them, you know, increased professional credibility, and it also gives you a chance to help out people who need it, which I find is often a good motivation all by itself.
Is there anything else that you want to add about the OTO's IT capability?
Well, one of the nicest things, I mean, just getting down to the nitty-gritty level, is up until a couple of years ago, we were renting shared hosting space with a server company that was quite good, but was quite limiting as well. Now we have what's known as a virtual private server, which is still shared, but we're compartmentalized, and it basically looks, from my point of view, as if I have complete control over a rather powerful machine, which gives me enormous flexibility. So part of the limiting factor on what gets done in the IT arena with respect to Grand Lodge is simply my imagination and the imagination of people who think up things that they want it to do. So, you know, I'm sure I'll regret saying this, but if anyone has any burning desires for neat things that should be at otousa.org, then let me know, because I'm always farming things for my to-do list.
Okay. Well, let's go back to what we were talking about earlier and talk about, you know, we talked about where the OTO was and the markers that you're talking, in particular the creation of U.S. Grand Lodge and the maturity that has been shown from a lot of the local bodies, the initiations, the officers. What other kind of maturing have you seen within the EGC?
Well, the EGC is a very interesting case, actually, and it touches on some of what I consider to be our greatest challenges. The EGC began as a largely independent organization. Its relationship to OTO has always been problematic historically. It had a separate origin, obviously, and was maintained as a separate but parallel organization throughout most of its history. Just for example, the bishop under whom I initially worked was a Minerval. She was uninterested in going further in OTO, but she was a bishop of EGC, which, you know, I tell that to the modern OTO members, and they're just appalled. But that was perfectly reasonable at the time, because EGC was its own thing. You could advance in that completely independently of anything you did in the OTO. Obviously, that has changed, and there's, you know, was a great deal of difficulty involved, both practical and emotional, in the process of sort of reintegrating or integrating EGC into OTO, making it effectively an arm of OTO. And obviously, the biggest steps taken there were the structuring of the levels of ordination in EGC as paralleling degrees in OTO. I mean, that is the point at which the two systems kind of snapped together. And that, you know, obviously caused a great deal of disruption, because it meant that people had to advance in OTO if they wanted to perform as ordained members of the clergy. And it also created a sort of feedback that people were expected to take the Mass seriously if they were sort of on the career advancement path in OTO. And both of those went against many people's conceptions as to what either organization was about, and caused, predictably, a lot of resentment, a lot of confusion, you know, all the normal things that accompany a large change of that form. It seems to me like most of that has shaken out, that people are pretty much at peace with the way that the two interrelate right now, and are working both systems in parallel, sort of the way that was conceived when this change was made. Now, the biggest issue before us right now is uniformity of practice. And this is something that the bishops discuss on a nearly continuous basis. You know, those are Yahoo groups again. Because there is a terrible tension any time that you try and make something a uniform practice within the OTO, whether it's initiations of the Mass or anything else, but particularly those two. Because there is a tension between the creation of an egregore, that to the extent that everyone is doing the same ritual, identifiably the same, with the same standards of practice and the same interpretations and so forth, you are creating a more powerful group. You are creating, by identification, that all of us are part of the same process. You are creating a more powerful group identification, a group mind, if you will. That is one extreme. The other extreme, of course, is to the extent that you allow absolute creativity, you're unleashing the maximum potential sort of magical energy. You're giving everyone total leeway to reinterpret anything however they will, and that maximizes the chances for serendipitous beauty and amazing results and so forth. And, of course, either extreme, either completely locking things down or allowing absolute anarchy, is unacceptable. You know, the absolute anarchy, you'd have people doing things called the OTO Mass that might be, you know, outlandish, ridiculous, embarrassing, illegal, whatever, and we can't allow that to happen because it threatens the organization on a very practical level. And at the other extreme, if we were to lock everything down and interpret every semicolon and period in the Mass with five pages of footnotes, it would kill the magic dead. You know, no one could transcend using that bureaucratic an approach. So we're left on the usual tightrope. I often say that any sentence about magic that does not contain the word balance is probably false. And this is the primary example of that that leaps to mind right now, because it's a terrible challenge to hit the sweet spot between those extremes.
Some of the changes lately with the EGC, without going into the details of them, have sparked a lot of debate and so forth.
Right.
Do you think there will ever be a time that any change or policy announcement won't have that kind of uproar from people?
Well, I imagine that there will always be something that will cause uproar. I mean, we're Thelemites. It's almost illegal for more than three or four of us to agree about something. And I find it healthy. It's great because I take enormous comfort from the fact that there are things that get people so pissed off that they're ready to punch someone and walk out, because it means people care. I would be far more concerned if everyone were just shrugging and going, yeah, whatever, because that would mean that the whole thing was dead. It's far, far better to have people passionate than not caring. And so, yes, people are going to fight for what they believe in. And there have been a few things that have happened specifically with the mass that I passionately disagree with and which I take every opportunity to go to the mat over, and which I am, you know, sworn that by the time I die, this is going to be changed because it's simply intolerable the way it is. But within that, I'm willing to work within the system. I'm willing to, you know, it's not quite to the hill I'm willing to die on threshold. So I, you know, work for change and try to deal with it as best I can in the meantime.
Compared to other organizations that have ecclesiastical membership and officers, how do you think the OTO is doing with its level of understanding of the mass, of its clergy, and is that a priority in the OTO, and how do you think it is being addressed?
Well, let me first answer the second question. Yes, it is certainly a priority. Jumping back to the first question for a moment, our level of clerical education lags very far behind, say, the Roman Catholic Church. They have the advantage of full-time clergy. You know, they have the ability to send people to seminary for 3 or 4 years to study intensively, to, you know, learn at the feet of people who are extraordinarily schooled in these matters. We, on the other hand, have clergy who have day jobs, who often are body masters or, you know, local teachers or whatever as well. So we're already working with a tiny fraction of just the raw time available to the clergy of some other religions to devote to study. That being said, I think that the average level of understanding and education and familiarity with our rites and the symbolism underpinning them of our clergy is increasing very rapidly over the last decade or so, especially, simply because we've kind of hit a critical mass of people who both know it themselves, are still around, and are willing to teach it. Locally, just for example, I teach a monthly seminar at LVX Oasis called Gnostic Boot Camp that anyone's permitted to attend, anyone that I'm supervising has to attend, and we go through an endless cycle of topics related to the Mass. Just last Thursday, we were doing the rites of baptism and confirmation, taking them apart into their component symbols and trying to see what they were accomplishing and how it related to the Mass, and you know, all the questions that you might want to ask, so that when you do those rites or see them, you truly understand what's going on. You're not just going through the motions, which I think is really essential. And I'm not the only one doing this sort of thing. I think that we're in a sort of renaissance of study of the Mass, that people are very interested in seeing what's going on in there. I mean, Crowley describes it as our central rite, public and private. So to my way of thinking, there's no more appropriate study for an OTO group to be doing than to be studying the Gnostic Mass.
In that end, I know the OTO is also moving towards some strategic planning and some other committees. And I know you're on the strategic planning committee. Is there anything that you can tell us about that?
Yeah, by all means. We're actually doing it. It's fascinating to me because I've been involved in planning efforts as part of my civil job and, you know, as part of the OTO before, but I've never participated in one that was being done in quite this rigorous a way. We actually have a really fascinating book that we're using as our blueprint titled Field Guide to Nonprofit Strategic Planning and Facilitation, which is just the kind of title that you think you should open up at bedtime, right? But it's actually very interesting because it lays out this very analytic, very scientific approach to figuring out what the organization is for and what its goals are, and who it's serving, who both the service providers and service consumers are for each of the services, what the obstacles are to each of those things. It appeals to my scientific side because it really starts off by breaking everything down into its smallest component pieces and drawing arrows between them and then builds up from there to finding out, you know, what the likely paths for improvement are, where the weaknesses are. And already in the process, we're identifying some things that I had not really realized were ambiguous or underserved or, you know, paradoxical or otherwise out of whack. And we're still in the analysis phase right now, but we're just about to turn the corner into recommendations. So that's going to be going on this summer, and hopefully by early fall we should be able to start telling people what came out of the cauldron after all of this stirring.
How do you think that once the recommendations come out of that and U.S. Grand Lodge has had time to kind of process them, also consulted with International Grand Lodge probably and Areopagus, so forth, when do you think the local members, specifically in U.S. Grand Lodge, obviously because
right.
this is a U.S. Grand Lodge initiative, but when do you think some of this will start filtering? Probably the beginning of next year?
The process of, you know, from this particular effort, probably, you know, this fall, this winter, things that were specifically found during this effort will begin to drop into practice. But you have to understand that this effort is just a particularly rigorous, structured approach to solving a problem that we've already been taking pass after pass after pass on. And a lot of the results of those analyses are already in play. I mean, just for example, there was an exhaustive analysis with the assistance of some legal advisors and accountants and so forth and so on about our nonprofit status with respect to how our local bodies are chartered and how we do business in the various states. And it turned out that the way we were doing it was risky. There were some exposures there potentially that, you know, if the wrong interpretation were taken, that we could be exposed to tax liabilities, losing our nonprofit status, et cetera. So over the course of the last several years, this started about 3 years ago, piece after piece, all of the parts of the puzzle were dropped into place such that that liability, that exposure, rather, was removed. And it involved cooperation from the local bodies. It involved establishing registered agents in the states that required that to register with the local tax authorities as a branch of our nonprofit. And it was this whole long involved sequence of activities that, you know, was I think a triumph of Grand Lodge in that it was big, complicated, required coordination across all the local bodies and all the states. It's also, you know, quite frankly, incredibly boring. I mean, you know, it's tax law. I mean, good grief, what can possibly be less exciting than tax law? So it didn't get a lot of press. It wasn't the sort of thing that makes a big splash with people. But if we hadn't done it, and if the, you know, the bad outcome had occurred, where would we look stupid? So there's a lot of things that in that category that have no sexiness attached to them but are critically important to the continued safe and effective operation of the body.
Do most of the things that you're talking about in this strategic planning fall into those kind of categories, the more mundane organizational stuff that really isn't that sexy, or is there also some larger scale things that will have
meaning? There's some very big things, and you can actually see the tip of one of them in Kava Colloquium, which is another one, because one of the biggest issues that we continue to identify is that local body officers need training. And Kava Colloquium is the sort of first, you know, nose in the door of that effort of getting the local body officers the training they need to handle problems in the field, to do similar training exercises for their bodies, to deal with issues as they come up without them turning into crises. And I think Kava has been very, very successful, but there's a lot of other types of training, a lot of other resources that we could bring to bear there. And some of those are coming up as part of our effort.
The other initiative that I know was started recently in Education Committee, talking about some of the, material putting it together for local bodies so that there's some uniformity in subjects that are taught. Do you know much about that, something you could talk about?
I know a little bit about that. I'm not involved on that committee, but as it happens, I know the secretary on that committee, and she and I have been talking a lot because she's very enthusiastic about it. So I can tell you just, you know, what I get secondhand from that. And uniformity is obviously a very loaded word. One of my favorite models of the local bodies of OTO is that they provide genetic diversity, that they're allowed to be different one from the other to the extent that we can manage that, because the idea is that we don't have the secret of what makes a healthy, successful local body in a particular location, And they may. So give them as much rope as we can without risking the health of the order and see what they do with it. See, you know, what surprises they might come up with. And then, like any good breeder, take, you know, the successful variations and try and apply them elsewhere. So that's very important that we leave people a lot of room to experiment, to try out teaching different things locally. We don't want to impose a uniform curriculum by any means. All that being said, there are certain topics, obviously, that are fairly important to have reasonable familiarity with if you're going to understand the OTO and its symbolism. So we want to make sure that all of the local bodies understand what those topics are and have the resources available to them to make it easy and effective to teach them, so that as part of whatever mix of classes that they might happen to be offering, the basics do get covered. And I think it's a very successful strategy. I mean, again, LVX is the one that I know best because that's where I do most of my work. We will mix a series on, say, Kabbalah 101 or yoga or astrology or, you know, the sort of core topics in with, say, a class on Aztec mysticism or a class on the works of Carl Jung or, you know, any of a thousand other things that are sort of off the beaten track of Western esotericism, but nonetheless very interesting to practicing magicians, Thelemites, and OTO members.
Wonderful. Well, actually, we need to wrap this up. If somebody wanted to get in touch with you, how could they do so?
Well, oddly enough, I'm on the net. It's webmaster at oto-usa.org.
Great. I really appreciate being on the podcast and giving everybody kind of an update on where the OTO is at, where it's going, and also I think the perspective that you have coming into the order over two decades ago, or almost two decades ago.
Coming up on two decades.
Yeah. I think it really adds a lot to kind of the whole picture and is really useful to the dialogue that I hope this podcast is generating. So thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Well, thanks very much for having me in
93.
This brings us to the end of another podcast. I want to thank the people who email, IM, Skype, and post on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. As I said before, please keep up the discussion and let others know about the podcast. I've been thinking about using Cafe Press to make some Thelema Coast to Coast merchandise, but want to get a good tagline for the show. So I'm making a contest. Submit your ideas for a short tagline, something like the podcast for the new eon, although that one's really kind of lame. Be creative and clever. The winner will get a free Thelema Coast to Coast t-shirt from Cafe Press. I'll announce the winner on podcast number 9. This means the deadline for submissions is July 4th, 2005. Again, keep spreading the word and voting on Podcast Alley. One other note, I am still looking for Thelemic-oriented music. If you are in a band or know of one that is Thelemic-centric, please email me. The closing music of this podcast is the song called The Crown by the band Nuit. I hope you enjoy it. Love's the law, love under will.
Thank you.